Welcome to Improbable Walks, the podcast that brings you to the streets of Paris wherever you are. My name is Lisa Passold, and I'm a writer and traveler who loves to walk in the City of Light. Every episode, we step into history by strolling down a different block of the city, exploring buildings and people of the past and of the present. If you're a regular listener, thank you for your time and ears. If you're just discovering the podcast, please check out my website, lisapassold.com, for photos, previous streets, and more information. You can encourage this podcast by subscribing, which lets you know when our new monthly episode is posted and helps Improbable Walks to find new listeners. Today, we're strolling the Grands Boulevards, which are especially glittery this time of year. My favorite holiday treat in Paris in December is to see a ballet at the Opéra Garnier and afterwards to walk up to admire the holiday windows in the big department stores. So today, let's start beside the metro Chaussée d'Antin, in front of Galerie Lafayette on Boulevard Haussmann. First of all, what are the Grands Boulevards, these grand boulevards of Paris? The term refers to a broad crescent half-circle of wide boulevards on the right bank, arcing loosely from the Bastille to the Arc de Triomphe, Boulevard de Bonne Nouvelle, Poissonnière, Montmartre, des Capucines, des Italiens, du Temple, de la Madeleine. These Grands Boulevards were originally created when Louis XIV replaced city ramparts in 1670, creating 4 kilometers of promenade, planted with trees. Later in the 1860s, these boulevards were reimagined as shopping and dining avenues, a crucial part of Baron Haussmann's plan for the expansion and renovation of Paris. We're going to start just behind the great Opéra Garnier at the metro stop Chaussée d'Antin. This corner is big brand name central with a large Sephora's, an H&M, and most importantly, the famous department store Galerie Lafayette. The unveiling of Galerie Lafayette's holiday decorations is always a media moment, although last year I preferred the windows at department store Le Printemps, which you can see if you walk 2 blocks further west on Boulevard Haussmann. The department store Le Printemps opened back in 1865. Galerie Lafayette is not quite so old. This main building here was finished in 1912. This is one of those buildings that looks much better inside than out here on the sidewalk, so it's worth stepping inside to see the great stained glass domed ceiling of the main space. If you don't know how it looks, check out my website, lisapassold.com. I'll put an image up there. The shop itself, Galerie Lafayette, is older than the building. The store was founded in the 1890s by Théophile Bader and his cousin. Théophile Bader understood style. He's the Parisian businessman who encouraged Coco Chanel to expand her business. And later, at the racetrack, he introduced Coco to business investor Pierre Wertheimer. This is interesting because Wertheimer's grandsons convinced the late great designer Karl Lagerfeld to reimagine Chanel Couture. And today, they still own the Chanel brand. Back in the Belle Époque, 19th century, the great department stores of the Grands Boulevards were revolutionary partly because of their huge windows. Glass technology made window shopping a brand new thrill for Parisians and for shoppers everywhere. Be sure to remember while wandering here that Parisians call window shopping, appropriately, lèche-vitrine, window-licking. After we've admired the holiday lights, we can cross Boulevard Haussmann at Place Diaghilev. We're now standing in front of the impressive performer entrance for the great Opéra Garnier. This place is really just the intersection of streets behind the opera house, and it's named for famous impresario Serge Diaghilev. In 1909, he presented his very first Saison Russe of ballet and opera in Paris at the Théâtre du Châtelet. The season was such a huge success that the following year, he presented Scheherazade here at the Opéra Garnier. In 1912, Diaghilev produced Stravinsky's The Firebird and Debussy's L'Après-midi d'un Faune, with Nijinsky as the faun. The year after that, in 1913, Diaghilev's premiere of The Rite of Spring at the Théâtre des Champs-Élysées led to rioting. Tuxedo-clad gents in the audience shoved and shouted until the music was drowned out. Nijinsky had to shout the beat timing from the wings so the dancers could keep in step because even they couldn't hear the music. Afterwards, sets and costumes were impounded, and the Théâtre des Champs-Élysées owner, Gabriel Astruc, was thrown out of his own theatre. But Diaghilev persevered. My favourite detail about The Rite of Spring is, well, first, imagine hearing the dissonant, pulsating chords for the first time. And Igor Stravinsky first played his Rite of Spring for Diaghilev on a piano in his Paris apartment. Diaghilev, poor man, interrupted Stravinsky to ask, "Will it last a very long time this way?" And the composer happily replied, "To the end, my dear, to the end." After this incredibly ambitious and successful period, Diaghilev eventually died penniless in Venice in 1929. Coco Chanel paid for his funeral and burial on the island of Saint Michel. For now, let's turn up our collar against the wintry wind and walk along the outside of the opera building. I love this opera house for its sheer chutzpah. Back in 1861, the emperor held a competition to award the most daring design for a new opera house, and the award went to a young working-class Parisian, Charles Garnier. Though the building was very expensive, mostly because the area was extremely swampy and the foundation was difficult to stabilize, it was a huge success by the time it opened on December 30, 1874. But by then, the Second Empire had fallen and France was once again a republic. The first performance in early January 1875 had a celebrity audience that nonetheless included many European royals. The over-the-top style invited criticism as well as praise. For instance, composer Claude Debussy apparently said the interior reminded him of a Turkish bath. Right now, December 2023, the front of the building is under scaffolding because it's being cleaned and restored. The work should be finished in a year, hopefully. Meanwhile, most of the rest of the building has been cleaned and is entirely visible from the street, so if you're there before the scaffolding comes down again, it's still very much worth the walk. As we go down to the left of the opera building on the Rue de Luc, we'll go past the old coach entrance for opera subscribers. Today, this is a very glam restaurant, but when the opera house opened, it was specifically designed with separate entrances for the wealthiest patrons, who would be arriving by carriage, versus the ordinary audience members who would arrive on foot and walk in the great front steps. In the original design, around the far side from here, there was a specially designed private entrance for the emperor. Today, this is used as the tour entrance. As we walk along, pay attention to the elaborate streetlights that line the edge of the opera. Some of them are voluptuous sculpted ladies holding gas lamps. These lamps are Charles Garnier's own design, which he claimed were inspired by the evening and morning stars. But a critic described them as being ladies of the night who'd wandered outside and been caught in a windstorm that had left them rather naked. Walking around to the front of the building, we come to the main grand entrance with the wide front stairs and many statues. Charles Garnier understood the needs of the evolving modern city of Paris. He knew that the growing middle class of Parisians wanted to make a grand entrance. The steps of the Opera Garnier are, in my opinion, perfect. They're generous and inviting, and people are constantly meeting each other here, sitting to rest, relax, eat their lunch, and listen to the musicians who often busk here in warmer weather. Of course, you do have to be careful of pickpockets, and you might want to be mindful of the scaffolding right now. But normally, the steps lead up to elaborate arches decorated with sculpture. Most of the statues are very sedate, with obvious classical draperies. But the second one in from the right is different. Look for a very crowded plinth depicting a delightful bacchanal. This is La Danse, sculpted by Jean-Baptiste Carpeau and unveiled in 1869, 5 years before the interior of the opera building was even completed. The sculpture looks simple enough. A smiling youth plays a tambourine, and women of various ages dance around him. But the sculpture triggered a huge scandal. Carpeau was a well-known, very successful sculptor, but the Parisian public was shocked by how ecstatic the dancers looked in this statue. In fact, the naked sculpted youth leading the dance was thoroughly androgynous. Carpeau used two different models, a woman modeled for the face of the youth, while a young male construction worker, who was working here on the opera site, modeled for the youth's joyful body. At the height of the controversy, in the night of August 26, 1869, one outraged person, never identified, threw an inkwell full of black ink at the Danse sculpture. The stone was cleaned, but public outrage demanded that La Danse be removed. Garnier offered to move it into the dance foyer, but a petition of protest was circulated by the dancers in the ballet corps. They didn't want it inside the building. The scandal got so bad that Emperor Napoleon III considered ordering a new sculpture entirely, but then the War of 1870 distracted everyone, and the sculpture stayed right here through the Prussian siege of Paris and the Commune. By the time the Commune had been broken, everyone had forgotten how shocked they once were by this sculpture. Today, the original is in the Arsay, and here is a copy on the opera's façade. In case you've seen the musical The Phantom of the Opera, I do want to say no, that's not a true story. But there is a natural branch of the Seine far underground here, which gave rise to the Phantom of the Opera underground lake idea for the novel, which inspired the film and the musical. There's in fact a body of water beneath the opera that's still there, even with the pumps, and the water has naturally occurring fish. The staff have been known to feed the fish, and the Paris Fire Department dives there occasionally to keep an eye on how everything is going. They have never reported finding the Phantom. Mind you, the famous chandelier scene in that musical is tragically inspired by real life. A counterweight on one of the chandeliers really did fall in the opera in 1896 and killed a woman in the audience. Cautiously, be mindful of traffic, let's cross the street to stand outside the Café de la Paix. This café was originally opened on the 30th of June, 1862, as part of the Grand Hôtel de la Paix. The building became an official historical heritage patrimoine site in 2000 and was extensively renovated. Personally, this café is not my favorite, but back in the day it was popular with writers like Émile Zola and composers like Massenet. But I feel that most interesting is around the corner. Look for the plaque over here at 14 Boulevard des Capucines. This is where, in 1895, the Lumière brothers showed their very first film in Paris. the Lumière brothers registered their patent for the cinemagraph in February of 1895. Their camera shot images at 16 frames per second, which became the standard for the next 25 years. The very first film, Workers Leaving the Factory, was a single shot, yes, of workers leaving a factory. In fact, the Lumière family factory. Was realistic movement of actual people, and Parisians first glimpsed this new amazing invention of cinema right here in an elegant basement salon of the Grand Café on the Boulevard des Capucines. The Lumière brothers welcomed the ticket-buying public to see six very short films. Soon they were pulling in 2,500 viewers per day. Their famous train sequence, train arriving in the station, was seen all over the world. It has to be admitted the Lumière brothers' titles were not inspired. But Louis and Auguste Lumière were focused on the documentary quality of film. They made films at the Paris Botanical Gardens with wealthy little children dressed up in their best clothes and with zoo employees dressed in smocks and workers' hats. These earliest films represent French Belle Époque life, and they're showing the same things we're still filming today in all of our TikTok videos and Instagram reels. We still make silly faces at the camera and film our dogs and our children and our travel experiences. From the very beginning, films set out to do exactly what we're still doing. By then, in Paris, still photographers had become normal. It makes sense that the Lumière brothers showed their work here in the Grand Boulevard area because we're actually near one of the very first and most famous photographic studios in the city. Let's walk down the Boulevard des Capucines going east away from the opera to number 35 on the Boulevard Capucines. If you visit my website, you'll be able to compare the way the building looked back in the 1800s with the way it looks today. It really hasn't changed as much as you'd expect. This photographic studio originally belonged to Gustave Legray, who was the artistic and ambitious son of a simple haberdasher working on the edge of Paris. Legray discovered Daguerre's invention as a young man in the 1840s. Legray initially took pictures of landscapes in Fontainebleau and around Paris. He was interested in photography as an art form. He wrote, "It's my deepest wish that photography, instead of falling within the domain of industry, of commerce, will be included among the arts. That is its sole true place." His images are very artistic, socially relevant, and often complex. Legray was ambitious. He set up his portrait studio in Paris at the very beginning of the Second Empire in a grand new building. A newspaper described his studio in 1856. From the center of the foyer, whose walls are lined with Cordoba leather, rises a double staircase with spiral balusters draped with red velvet and fringe, leading to the glassed-in studio and a chemistry laboratory. In the salon, lighted by a large bay window overlooking the boulevard, is a carved oak armoire in the Louis XIII style. Opposite, over the mantelpiece, is a Louis XIV mirror, and the rich crimson velvet hanging that serves as a backdrop. Lastly, on a Venetian table of richly carved and gilded wood, are highly successful test proofs of the eminent personages who have passed before Monsieur Legray's lens. Unfortunately, though wildly successful, Legray was truly awful with money. He went into debt and fled Paris, abandoning his studio and his family. Legray fled to the Mediterranean, eventually spending the rest of his long life in Egypt, taking pictures and working as a drawing tutor to the sons of the Pasha. His best photography student stayed behind in Paris. Nadar said of his teacher, Legray could not resign himself to turn his studio into a factory. And unlike his teacher, Nadar was very good at making money. Nadar took over Legray's former photography studio here on the Boulevard des Capucines. Nadar's real name was Gaspar Félix Tournachon, and he succeeded where Legray had failed, both as a businessman and as an artistic photographer. I secretly think that's because Ernestine, Nadar's practical wife, ran the books for the business. I have a great staged portrait of the Nadar and Ernestine couple on the website. Nadar started taking photographs at the beginning of the Second Empire. He was a pioneer in all respects, most particularly in his use of artificial lighting in photography, and he was absolutely modern in his free access approach to photography. This is Nadar describing public interest in his book, Quand j'étais photographe. He's talking about using Bunsen elements to light his studio. He writes, "The regular return each evening of this light, so little utilized, arrested the crowd on the boulevard, and drawn like moths to the flame, a good many of the curious, both the friendly and the indifferent, came to climb up the stairs to our studio to find out what was going on there. These visitors, some well-known or even famous, represented every social class. They were the more welcome insofar as they furnished us with a free supply of models, variously disposed towards the novel experience." Nadar's free use of this new medium, not unlike some of the apps and innovations of recent years where the public can participate for free, helped create a wonderful commercial audience for his photographs. Nadar had a long and often lucky life, and he was fortunate to meet all the big literary figures of the era, from Georges Sand to Victor Hugo to Jules Verne. He knew scientists, politicians, cutting-edge tastemakers, and he was also friends with many painters, especially the ones we now think of as the Impressionists. We might assume that at the shocking beginning of photography, painters would view the new technology with dislike. But Parisian painters, especially the Impressionists, loved the new inventions of daguerreotype and photography. They immediately understood the creative ideas behind photography and also how a camera could be useful to their own work. Many of the Parisian painters were friends with Nadar, and they appreciated his photographs both for their social commentary and for their practicality. In fact, some of the painters used photography so that they could paint from the images later on. And in April 1874, when the first Impressionists were desperately looking for a space to show their rejected paintings, their friend Nadar lent them his superbly located studio here on the Boulevard des Capucines. And it was here that the Impressionists put on their first exhibition. In the new year, I'll stroll in the other direction along the boulevard to talk about some more wild café and opera history that lingers on the Boulevard des Italiens. But for now, I'm going to walk back to the Opéra Garnier and have a glass of champagne at the counter of the Entracte, which is a lovely little restaurant-café over at 1 rue Aubert. Cheers and happy holidays! If you enjoyed this improbable walk, please subscribe to the podcast. Check out images on my website, lisapassel.com. Many thanks, as always, to my tiny podcast team, Bremner Fletcher for tech help, and David Simmons for the atmospheric accordion theme music. Until the next time, we go walking into Paris history together.